Vince Cowley here with another edition of the Windy Valley Digest podcast. We are searching through the musty corners of bookshops, flea markets, libraries, and web archives to bring you stories that have been lost in time. Today's podcast is episode number 2, and we continue with our 17-part series of Lawrence Clark's novel of the Secret Service. In our last episode, John Manton agreed to take on the identity of Bernard Treves in order to pay back money that disappeared while in his keeping. The method of payment, as well as details of the assignment, remain a mystery. Perhaps we'll find out more as we present chapters 3 and 4 of Bernard Treves' Boots. We'll get to the program in a few minutes. First, let's talk about how you can support the Windy Valley Digest. For now, we won't solicit Patreon memberships or advertise products for you to purchase. The best way you can support us is to go to the Windy Valley Digest Facebook page and click on the three little dots on the right side of the menu bar just below the main title. In the drop-down menu, click on Follow. That way you get notified on your Facebook feed whenever we have new content available. While you're there, give us a thumbs up. Our Facebook link is in the show notes for this episode. Today's World War I soldier's letter is from an unknown French soldier. He was reportedly a painter, but the war seemed to bring out the poet in the young man. Unable to bring himself to write about the horrors he experienced in the war, especially after 1,200 of his company were killed during a 5-day period, he preferred to write about the certainties of duty and effort.
January 23, 1915. When my trials become less hard, then I begin to think, to dream, and the past that is dear to me seems to have that same remote poetry which in happier days drew my thoughts to distant countries. A familiar street or certain well-known corners spring suddenly to my mind. Just as in other days, islands of dreams and legendary countries used to rise at the call of certain music and verse. But now there is no need of verse or music. The intensity of dear memories is enough. I have not even any idea of what a new life could be. I only know that we are making life here and now. For whom and for what age? It hardly matters. What I do know, and what is affirmed in the very depths of my being, is that this harvest of French genius will be safely stored, and that the intellect of our race will not suffer for the deep cuts that have been made in it. Who will say that the rough peasant, comrade of the fallen thinker, will not be the inheritor of his thoughts? No experience can falsify this magnificent intuition. The peasant's son, who has witnessed the death of the young scholar or artist, will perhaps take up the interrupted work, be perhaps a link in the chain of evolution which has been for the moment suspended. This is the real sacrifice, to renounce the hope of being the torchbearer. To a child in a game, it is a fine thing to carry the flag, but for a man it is enough to know that the flag will be carried. And that is what every moment of august nature brings home to me. Every moment reassures my heart. Nature makes flags of everything. They are more beautiful than those to which our little habits cling.
The young French soldier has not been heard of since one of the severe battles in the Argonne in 1915. A suitable epitaph, however, can be found in his own words in a letter to his mother. I hope that when you think of me, you will have in mind all those who have left everything behind, their families, their surroundings, their whole social environment, all of those whom their nearest and dearest think only in the past, saying, "We once had a brother who years ago withdrew from the world. We know nothing of his fate." The reader for today's letter, as well as the upcoming story, is David Wales. Without further delay, the Windy Valley Digest presents chapters 3 and 4 of Bernard Treves' Boots.
Chapter 3, 6 days later, Manton found himself once more in Lymington, alone in Treves' lodgings, in the crowded room littered with that young man's desirable possessions. Those possessions were, for the time being, his own. Even Treves' name was his, for, carrying out his bargain, Treves had vanished from the scene. Again, Manton fell to wondering why the other had been so anxious to dispossess himself of name and identity. There was nothing criminal in the matter, he was assured of that, otherwise Captain Gilbert would not have had a hand in it. The idea that the lieutenant had suffered from shell shock, and desired to hide himself from all who knew him for a time, until he had recovered, came to Manton, and struck him as feasible. He had himself known quite a number of peculiar manifestations of this particularly mysterious disease. In any case, whatever Treves' reasons, it mattered little to Manton at that moment. "I have simply got to make myself act as Treves, and to do the best I can in Treves' shoes for the time being." A few days earlier, the young man had written him a letter in which he had said, "Use everything of mine as if it were your own. It is only fair, if you get the kicks meant for me, you should get the halfpence as well. I have few relations, and none of them are likely to bother you. When we shall meet again, I do not know. But in the meantime, au revoir. I wonder what you will feel like this time next year." Manton, in the quiet of the room, took some considerable time trying to realize his new circumstances, and gradually the sense of strangeness and mystery that enveloped him began to fade away. In all his life, Manton had been used to the buffets and hard knocks of fate. He began to wonder what his immediate future in Treves' shoes held for him. Both parents having died in India, he had been educated from a small fund in the hands of a guardian, first in Germany and later at Rugby. After that he spent 2 years at Bonn. His resources were at an end, and the guardian, feeling that he had done his duty, left him to fend for himself. A period of hard going had followed until the war broke out, whereupon he precipitately enlisted in the 100,000. If he had waited a little longer, a commission would have been thrust upon him, as it was upon all public school men in any way eligible. Treves' past, Manton surmised, had not been of that nature. For despite the poorness of the young man's lodgings, all his belongings were of the costliest order. And all these belongings were now his, Manton's, to do with as he liked. The idea came to him to write to Captain Gilbert, thanking him for the amicable intervention that had wrought this change in his circumstances. He sat down, drew forth a sheet of Treves' note-paper, and had taken up a pen, when a knock came at the door, and the landlady appeared. "You'd like some tea, sir, wouldn't you?" "Yes, thank you," answered the young man. "I've dusted the room every day, sir, since you've been away," said the landlady. "It's exactly as I left it," responded he truthfully. She was looking at him across the width of the little room, but there was no doubt or curiosity in her gaze. She had accepted him instantly on his arrival that day, as Bernard Treves, and even now, looking at him full and closely, no doubt of deception entered her mind. "I wonder what she'd think," he pondered inwardly, "if Treves were to come in behind her now." But no such dramatic event occurred. The landlady brought up his tea, and later furnished him with a bottle of whiskey, a siphon of soda, and a glass. Next morning, when she cleared these things away, she was surprised to find that no more than one peg of whiskey had been taken. "Wasn't you feeling well, sir, last night?" she asked. "Quite," answered Manton, who was busy with an excellent breakfast. She went away wondering. Until that day she had never known Mr. Treves to drink less than a half bottle of whiskey in the course of an evening. During the morning, John went for a stroll in the town, and on his return the landlady handed him a letter which had arrived by the post in his absence. Manton took it up to his room and noticed that the handwriting was sprawling and shaky. Twice he read the superscription, "Bernard Treves, Esquire, 15, Sade Road, Lymington."
He hesitated several minutes before breaking open the envelope. He felt as though he were stepping beyond the pale of decency in opening the letter addressed to another man. Then he recalled Treves' admonition, "Everything that is mine is yours." He tore open the envelope. Within was a single sheet of paper headed, "Heatherfield Grange, Freshwater." Manton quickly scanned the contents. "Dear Bernard, they tell me you are in hiding, as well you may be, but if you have a spark of decency left in you, you will come here to me at the first opportunity. There are things I have to say to you. You have dishonored and disgraced the family name, but I have still a faint hope that you will retrieve yourself at the last moment. Your affectionate father, R.T. For many minutes John Manton sat staring at this letter, staring from the stiff, sprawling writing out into the little street and back again. All that day he pondered upon the missive he had received from Treves' father. He wondered what it was Treves had done, and why he should have been skulking and hiding at that address. A sense of uneasiness swept over him, and was succeeded by a violent curiosity. For the first time he felt vividly interested in Treves and Treves' history, and at the same time doubtful and uneasy. Unpleasant and difficult situations presented themselves to his mind. Next morning, as a result of a decision he had taken, he was on his way to Freshwater by midday. At 3 o'clock in the afternoon he walked through the town and out to Heatherfield Grange, which he discovered to be a large, many-chimneyed, many-windowed Elizabethan mansion, standing in a spacious, heavily wooded park. The mansion itself was approached by a long carriage drive, too much overshadowed by trees, and when Manton reached the lodge gates, a bent old man, who was sweeping leaves from the path, hurried forward and drew open the gate for him to enter. The man drew himself up and saluted. "Good day, Master Bernard." Manton nodded and smiled. As he walked along the drive towards the grand old house, his pulse beat quickened. After all, had he a right to act the part? Was it honorable and fair that he should thus step into another man's shoes? The undergardener had taken him for Bernard Treves. The whole world evidently was prepared to believe in the deception. But there was Treves' father to face. Naturally, Treves' father would detect an impostor in a moment. But was he an impostor? Was it not probable that the elder Treves also was aware of what had occurred? The broad front door of the mansion was opened to him. A white-haired butler with pouches under his eyes and a general air of world-weariness looked at him from the threshold and slowly lifted his eyes in surprise. "Good afternoon, sir," said the butler. He took Manton's hat and stick and deferentially stood aside. "Your father will indeed be pleased and surprised to see you, sir," he said as he closed the door. His manner was studiously civil, and yet somehow Manton felt a lack of cordiality towards himself in the butler's tone. "Possibly he's a privileged servant," he thought, "and does not like Mr. Bernard." "Where is the colonel?" he asked after a moment's hesitation. "In the library, sir, as usual. Will you go up at once?" "Yes." He wondered consumedly where the colonel's room might be, and experienced a pleasant thrill of impending event. He attempted a little harmless finesse to discover the way. "Perhaps you will go first and tell him I am here." "Very good, sir." The butler looked at him meditatively for a moment, then went to a side table and took up a silver salver containing 3 letters and a telegram. Manton seized the moment to survey the heavy splendor of the dark antique furniture, the wide spaces of the hall, and the richness of the rugs scattered over the polished floor. High above the mantel shelf hung a portrait in oils of a personage in 18th-century costume. Descending to the middle of the hall was a wide oak balustraded staircase, carpeted in scarlet. A single flight ascended to the first floor, then branched to right and left. "Your letter, sir," The butler was standing at Manton's elbow, with the silver salver extended. John took up the three letters and the telegram. A renewed and intensified disinclination to pry into Bernard Treves's affairs seized him. He was about to put letters and telegram into his pocket when the butler spoke in his firm, polite voice. There was a note of reproach in his tone, however. "The telegram came 2 days ago, sir." "Oh!" exclaimed Manton, and under the bleak eye of the butler he disinterred it from his pocket, tore open the envelope, and read the contents. The telegram had been dispatched from Camden Town, and ran, "Wire when you can come. Of course I will forgive you, Elaine." He was conscious, as he read the words, that the butler's eyes were fixed steadily upon him. Then the old servant turned and preceded him towards the broad staircase. They ascended to the first landing, and here the butler wheeled to the right and halted before a double green baize door. The elderly man knocked, paused for a moment, then pushed open the door and stepped into a room lined with books, a spacious, luxuriously furnished apartment with two mullioned windows overlooking the park. John, following him, saw him cross to a deep, high-backed armchair near the hearth. "Mr. Bernard's here, sir," he announced, standing before the chair. There was a movement in the chair, then a tall, soldierly, gray-haired man revealed himself, leaning on a stick, and looked across at Manton. He looked at him with a cold, inimical gaze, and, until the butler had closed the door and departed, did not utter a word. Then he spoke. "So you've come, you dog, have you?" The almost savage intensity of dislike and contempt in his tone struck the young man like a blow in the face. "I got your letter," he began. "Oh, yes, I found out where you were. Well," he went on harshly, "there is no need for us to waste compliments on each other. We will settle the business that is to be settled at once." He moved shakily towards a desk in the middle of the room, using his stick as a support. Manton, seeing his frailty, hurried forward to assist him, but the old man drew himself erect, raised his stick, and flashed a look at him of utter repulsion. "Do not dare to lay a hand on me," he said violently. When he reached his desk, he seated himself in a big swivel chair, drew out a drawer, and flung certain documents on the table. From under his eyebrows he glowered at Manton. "Sit down," he commanded. John moved to the table side and occupied a chair near his elbow. Among a pile of documents, Colonel Treves searched for a certain typewritten sheet. He found it at length, a long yellow piece of official paper. "Listen to this," he commanded. From the table beside him he took up a square reading glass and deciphered the typewritten paper with faded gray eyes. "This," he vouchsafed, raising his eyes, "is from my old good friend, General Whiston." He paused a moment, and John seized the opportunity to intervene. "May I say a word, sir?" "No," thundered Treves. Then he read aloud in a voice vibrant with emotion. "My dear Treves, your boy had every chance. It was the merest fluke in the world that he escaped as easily as he did. He is not of the right stuff, and my condolences are with you. I wish I could suggest something, but I cannot. I know, old friend, what a tragedy this must be to you." The colonel stopped abruptly, flung down his reading-glass, and looked into Manton's face. "Well," he demanded, "what do you think of that?" Manton said nothing. "Can you read between the lines?" questioned the elder man. "It suggests," said John, after a moment's hesitation, "that the punishment meted out to me was a light one." "I see you are as evasive as ever," retorted Colonel Treves. He turned and smote the open letter twice with the back of his hand. "In this letter, General Whiston," he measured his words slowly, "tells me, by implication, that you are guilty of cowardice in the face of the enemy. You, A Treves! Then, in a moment, the anger that had vivified him seemed to fade. He appeared to Manton to become suddenly old, bowed, and pitiful. The expression on his face was one of anguish. The dishonor that had befallen his name was no less than torture to him. But once again he recovered himself and gripped the arms of his chair with both white-knuckled hands. "You know the just punishment for cowardice in the face of the enemy?" He was leaning towards Manton now. His mouth twitched, but there was a blaze in the old gray eyes. "I know it, sir," said John quietly. The colonel drew in his breath slowly and sat erect. "Ah, you know. And having escaped that punishment, and knowing yourself to be guilty, you skulk in hiding. You fail to seize the one chance that is open to you to redeem the past." "What is the chance?" inquired Manton, forgetting himself for a moment. The colonel stared at him in astonishment. "The chance of re-enlistment, of course. Instead of doing that," he went on, "you write me a whining letter, saying you can't stand the trenches, you can't face it, your nerves—" "Bah! Nerves, my God, and you a Treves!" He hurled these words forth with a contempt and loathing that was like a blow in the face. But Manton noticed that he was breathing heavily. The emotional intensity of his feelings was wearing on him, and the young man felt a sudden tenderness towards this old, stricken, bitterly disappointed father. "Is it too late now, sir?" he asked quietly. "What?" "Is it too late for me to make good?" "Talk!" exclaimed the colonel in bitter derision. "Always talk with you! You don't mean that any more than you meant any of the lying promises you made to me in the past. You have always been a liar, a spendthrift, and a fool. And now, added to all these things, to your gambling and your profligacy, you've finished as a—" He paused, and Manton ventured, "In regards to a way out, sir?" The colonel looked at him with renewed ferocity. Then his expression slowly changed. For some seconds he was silent, and without a glance at Manton, he began to fumble at a drawer. He drew it open at length and groped in its interior. His hand shook visibly, but there was something in his attitude, some strange intensity of purpose, that riveted Manton's attention. Presently the colonel discovered the object he sought, and revealed from the depths of the drawer an automatic pistol. "If you have a shred of honor left, you will know what to do," he said grimly. He reached out and laid the weapon on the corner of the desk at the young man's side.
Before moving on to Chapter 4, we would like to let you know about our YouTube channel, where we present stories in what we call an illustrated audiobook format. We're just finishing up our Tom Sawyer series. This particular book is presented as a dramatic reading where voice actors play various roles in the story. By combining these readings with classic artwork from early editions of a book or magazine, we bring you a truly unique experience. To visit our channel, simply click on the video option of our main menu, or follow the link in the show description. Once you're there, don't forget to subscribe to the channel and click on the bell to receive notifications of our newly released episodes. And now, Chapter 4 of Bernard Treves' Boots.
Then Colonel Treves rose slowly to his feet, took up his stick, and moved towards the door of the room. With his hand on the doorknob, he pointed his stick at the weapon on the table. Manton had remained motionless, utterly at a loss. Now the old soldier's meaning gradually revealed itself. "You want me to take this and," broke in Colonel Treves, "use it to recover such shreds of honor as are left to you." He drew open the door. "Thanks," said Manton, taking the pistol from the desk. He slipped the weapon into his hip pocket. The colonel halted, looking back at him in surprise. "What are you going to do?" "I am going to use it," answered John, "if occasion arises." He saw the colonel hesitate. Some deep emotion seemed to stir within him. Then, with an effort, he turned swiftly and was about to hurry from the room. Manton strode towards him. "There was another way out?" he questioned rapidly. "There was, and you failed to take it. You whined that you couldn't face the army again. You, a Treves. In the past, before my time and yours," went on the colonel, suddenly violent again, "there have been Treves who have been fools and spendthrifts. There may have been Treves who kept their honor none too clean. But never in our long line has there been a coward until you came, until you grew up to be a curse to my existence and made my life a shame to me." His lips trembled. The old, proud head was held aloft, but a world of desolation dwelt in the faded eyes. On a sudden impulse, John gripped him by the hand. He could feel the old man resisting him, seeking to free himself. "I want to make you a promise, sir," he said. "I am going to ride the first thing in the morning. I have a friend there who will help me to get back into the army." The colonel narrowed his eyes and tried to read the expression on his face. "There is a new ring in your voice, Bernard," he said after a moment's pause, "but I cannot trust you." He turned and walked away. John saw him go, using his stick for support, and felt a renewed pity for the old broken father. He spent that night at an inn in Freshwater, and took the first train next morning for Ryde. Here at the recruiting office he presented himself before Captain Gilbert. This plump and comfortable officer was busy at his work when John stepped into the office. His shadow fell upon Captain Gilbert's desk, and the elder man looked up quickly. "Great Scott!" he exclaimed. He stared wide-eyed at Manton for a moment, and John broke into a smile. "I see you mistook me for Treves." "I did," said Gilbert, leaning forward and looking into his face. "The resemblance is really closer than I thought at first." "Well," he said, "you've done your part of the bargain splendidly. You earned the money you needed, and you've lifted a great load off the minds of several deserving persons, including myself." "I should like to know how I've done that," said Manton. "It seems to me the only service I have rendered has been to myself." "You forget the battery at Scarthoe Head. You made up the deficiency, and the colonel's delighted with you, Manton." "Thanks to you and young Treves, I was able to put matters straight there." "You have probably saved young Treves from going utterly to the devil," said Gilbert. "I'll tell you about that later. I'm busy till 1 o'clock, but come to my hotel then, and we'll have lunch together." "But I am here on business myself," protested Manton. He was feeling cheerful and particularly satisfied with the course of events so far. "What is your particular business?" inquired Gilbert. "I want to get back into the army." Gilbert looked at him for a moment. Of course, he said hastily. "I'd forgotten that. We will discuss the subject at lunchtime." Until lunchtime, Manton was free to stroll upon the pier and consider his situation. He felt a deep curiosity to know what had happened to the man whose clothes he was wearing, to Treves, whose money he was jingling in his pocket, whose excellent cigarettes he had smoked. At 1:45 he threw his cigarette end over the rail into the water, and, turning, made his way to the hotel where Gilbert was staying. He found the captain already there, busy mixing a salad at a table in the corner of a small dining room. There were half a dozen tables in the room, none of which were as yet occupied. "Sit down, Manton," invited Captain Gilbert, as John entered. "I always mix my own salads. What will you have? There's the menu." John chose a dish and accepted his host's invitation to divide with him a bottle of Chablis. During the meal, Captain Gilbert talked on general matters, but at length the conversation appeared to drift round to the subject of Treves. "Old Treves took you for granted, eh?" asked the captain. "His eyesight isn't good," answered John, "but he suspected nothing." "And Gates, the butler?" "He called me Mr. Bernard the moment he saw me. Also, he gave me Treves' letters and a telegram. I didn't read the letters, but the telegram..." Manton put his hand in his inner pocket. "Perhaps I'd better hand them all over to you now." "Not so fast," Gilbert said, pushing the letters and the telegram back across the table towards Manton. "As a matter of fact, I can't hand them to Treves just now, as I have persuaded him to go to a nursing home for a time. A very good friend of his father's, General Whiston, recommended that something of the sort should be done with him months ago." "Treves did not give me the impression of being actually ill," Manton observed. "He wasn't, but his nerves were all to rags. He was in such a state of acute neurasthenia that I expected him to lay hands on himself any minute. Anyway, where he is, he will be safe for a while. He will be out of his father's way, and the discipline of this particular nursing home may pull him together." John lit a cigarette and smoked thoughtfully. There was evidently something on Gilbert's mind, something of which he wished to unburden himself. John waited, and at last the elder man broke the silence again. "Manton," he said earnestly, "I want you to do me a particular favor." John inquired the nature of the favor. "I want you," went on the captain, "to sustain Treves' personality for a little longer. He is in good hands in the nursing home, and for the time being has vanished from the public gaze." Gilbert paused, and again appeared to hesitate. What he had to say was very difficult to frame in words. He wished to hint at something that was the merest suspicion in his own mind. Two or three times he was on the verge of putting his thoughts into words, and each time the effort appeared too much for his gift of expression. Finally he leaned back in his chair. "Manton," he said, "I cannot tell you all I think and suspect, but I will give you such confidences as I can." He paused for a moment, then went on. "Since Treves came back from France, he appears to have got into the hands of undesirable company. One of his rooted ideas, possibly the result of his drug habit, is that someone is watching him, and that, for some reason or other, his life is in danger." John listened quietly, then, when the other had finished, he observed seriously, "So far as I can see it, you want me to continue my impersonation of Treves until he is cured and comes out of the nursing home." "That is it, exactly," said Gilbert. "You are putting a great deal of trust in me," answered John. At that, Gilbert stretched out his hand and gripped John's fingers heartily. "Manton," he said, "you and I are in this together for the good of the cause. Not only for Treves and the old colonel, but perhaps for bigger issues." "I don't get your meaning," said John. "Don't ask it. Trust me as I trust you. And now, to get back to the matter at hand," he said, resuming his ordinary tone, "perhaps it would be worth your while to open those two letters." As John obediently tore open the envelopes and read the contents of the letters, Gilbert called the waiter and paid for the two lunches. One of the letters was a typewritten screed from a quack doctor in which he claimed to cure any victim of the drug habit within the space of 3 months. John experienced a real feeling of pity for Treves as he read the quack's fraudulent promises. The second letter contained two lines only on a single sheet of paper with the printed heading, 208 St. George's Square, S.W. The letter ran, "Dear Treves, I must see you at once. You understand, it is essential that you should come to me without delay. Tomorrow night at 9 o'clock I shall expect you. Yours, G. Manners." Manton handed both letters to Gilbert, who studied them carefully. "I haven't a notion who G. Manners is," mused the captain, when he had read the letter through a second time. "But he may be one of the friends Treves ought to get rid of, and for that reason I should advise you to call on him tomorrow." Manton was thoughtful for a moment. "What if he discusses matters I know nothing about? Treves' past life is a blank to me." "Come," said Gilbert, touching him lightly on the arm, "you are playing a part. You are not such a fool as not to play it well. I admit there are certain little precautions you may find it wise to take. In the first place, you must have a go at copying Treves' degenerate handwriting. You might also keep in mind that Treves is overstrung, lacking in willpower, and so much a victim of the cocaine habit that he would do anything, short of murder, to get the drug when the craving is upon him. As to Treves' past life, it seems to me that a victim of the drug habit can be afflicted with convenient lapses of memory when occasion arises. Manton glanced at the captain's pleasant, fat face, and the thought crossed his mind that there was a good deal more cleverness behind Gilbert's amiable exterior than he had at first realized. He forthwith decided to go to town that night. London always held a vivid attraction for him, and he had not had the pleasure of visiting it since his journey through its streets in an ambulance on his return from France. Some weeks in hospital had followed that visit, then had come his transference to the RGA at Scarthoe Head, and now, with returned health and in new, strange, and portentous circumstances, he was to visit London again. Mr. Manners, the mysterious, imperative writer of the letter, had demanded to see Treves at 9 o'clock. The hour of John's arrival was 8, and he was in a hurry. He was impatient to plunge into whatever adventure awaited him. Without bothering to engage a room for the night, he deposited his bag in the cloak-room at Waterloo Station, and set out to find St. George's Square. He arrived at the corner of the square, the embankment corner, at precisely 8:30. The square's decorous, solemn-looking houses, with heavy-pillared porticos, struck him as gloomy in the extreme. The only individual upon the long strip of pavement which ran the length of the west side of the square was himself. His footfalls appeared to echo with inordinate resonance in the areas as he made his way towards number 208. It was not his intention to ring the bell immediately. In the first place he wanted to reconnoitre the house, to see if it were possible to judge of the house's occupants by its exterior. This thought occupied his mind when a taxi sped into the square and drew to a halt within half a dozen yards of him. The taxi had stopped behind him, and its occupant had alighted. "That's all right, half an hour," said a curt voice in a cultured accent. The chauffeur nodded and slammed the taxi door. The young man who had alighted hurried forward, past John, and continued down the square. Without paying over special attention, John noticed that he was tall, that he wore a morning coat of distinguished cut, that his light gray felt hat was of expensive quality, and that the pearl in his tie-pin was also, if genuine, of exceptional value. He was of John's height and age, fair-haired, blue-eyed, and with a slight toothbrush mustache. His features were large and heavy-boned, without being harsh. Two things John noticed as he hurried past. One was that he carried a silk-lined light overcoat over his arm, and the other that he wore a service-rendered badge on the lapel of his coat. Invalided from the army, thought John. All the same, he doesn't look as if there was much the matter with him. John continued to walk until he reached the corner of the square. Then he turned, and as he did so, he saw the tall young man flit up the steps of a house a considerable distance away. John fixed his eyes on the portico of this particular house and walked towards it, and as he neared the door he realized that the young man had entered the very house at which he also had an appointment, number 208. For a moment Manton paused, hesitated, then passed on. Before making the plunge into whatever adventure awaited him, he wanted still further to consider the situation. In the meantime, the stranger, who had alighted from the taxi, was now within the hall of Mr. Manners' residence. He had opened the door with a Yale key and had admitted himself. The hall was narrow and somewhat dark, and the young man laid his gold-headed cane noisily on a little table and began to draw off his gray gloves. A door at the back of the house opened noiselessly, and a somber-faced, sallow-complexioned butler advanced. "Mr. Manners is in, of course?" demanded the young man in a voice that rasped a little. "Yes, Herr Baron, in the library." The visitor nodded curtly, ran swiftly up the stairs, turned to the left, and opened a door on the first landing. He entered a room where the curtains had already been drawn. Two electric chandeliers, one on either side of the hearth, illuminated the apartment. A large bookcase occupied one wall of the room, and in the middle of the floor was a business-like table scattered with papers. On the table was a green-shaded reading lamp, and by its illumination a man sat at work, busily writing. He looked up as the stranger entered, then sprang quickly to his feet. He was a tall man of 50, uncomfortably stout, with a fleshy neck that protruded over his collar at the back. The big man's iron-gray hair was short, his nose broad and short, and his lips thick and pouting. Despite his inelegance of figure, he was dressed, with an attempt at smartness, in a well-cut frock coat and newly creased trousers. His heavy eyebrows shielded his eyes, hiding his expression from any but the closest scrutiny. For a man of his excessive bulk, he showed extreme activity on his feet. "I didn't expect you tonight," he said. He placed a chair near the desk for the younger man to seat himself. His visitor, however, stood still and fixed him with a direct, cold stare. "Well, Manners," he demanded, "what have you to say for yourself?" Manners shrugged his heavy shoulders and displayed the palms of his hands. "Nothing, Herr Baron," he said, "except that I have done my best. Won't you sit down?" The young man took a cigarette from his case and lit it. "Your best is damned bad," he said. "I exercised such judgment as I have," returned the other, in a tone of abasement. "Judgment alone is of no avail," retorted the other. "What we want is aggressive action. We don't get that from you. You talk and think and scheme." The other ventured a faint note of protest. "I was chosen, Herr Baron." "I don't want to hear your history," returned the younger man coldly. "I want to know about this expedition that is being prepared by the Eastern Command, that has been under preparation for the past 6 weeks." "I gave you such figures, Herr Baron, as I was able to collect." The young man crossed to the hearth and stood leaning with his back against the mantel-shelf. "Doesn't it occur to you," he demanded after a moment's silence, "that figures are only a detail? Figures are something any fool could gather. What Berlin wants to know is, what is this expedition's objective, where is it bound for, also what port it sails from, and when?" The elder German, Gottfried Manwitz by name, though he figured in the London directory as Godfrey Manners, turned nervously towards his desk and began to search among the papers. An expression of relief crossed his face as he took up a particular sheet of paper. "That is the date, Herr Baron," he said, "when the expedition will sail, and also the place of departure." The young man took the sheet, scrutinized it with frowning brows for a moment, then lifted his eyes and looked into Manwitz's fat face with cold, contemptuous gaze. "Excellent," he said cuttingly, "wonderful and utterly useless. You provide headquarters with all this detail, and fail to give the one vital, useful piece of information, the sole item that headquarters requires." "It is very difficult, Herr Baron," apologized Manners. "You and I, Manwitz," retorted the younger man, "are retained in London for the sole purpose of overcoming difficulties." He paused a moment and looked complacently for the first time in the elder man's face. "For instance, I myself have overcome quite a number of difficulties." "Indeed, that is true, Herr Baron," conceded Manners. "I expect you to do the same. Since you let the inflexible and the invincible vanish to the Falkland Islands without any one of us being aware of the fact, Berlin doesn't think so highly of your attainments as before the war. For my part," he went on, "I find you too much of a dreamer." He paused. Someone had knocked lightly on the door of the room. "Open it, Manwitz," he commanded. The big man crossed lightly to the door and drew it open. Upon the threshold stood the somber-countenanced butler. The tall young man from the hearth called aloud to him. "Well, Conrad, what is it?"
"Mr. Treves, Herr Baron, to see Herr Manners."
"Thank you, Conrad," said Manners. He closed the door and turned to his superior. "This is one of my instruments, Herr Baron, arrived to-night from the Isle of Wight. You approved of him when I gave you his dossier a month ago." "He is the British officer who was cashiered," returned the other swiftly. "Takes drugs and generally gone to pieces?"
"The same, Herr Baron."
"Is he quite," he paused, "quite amenable to your orders?"
"I flatter myself that I can do a good deal with him," Manwitz answered with pride. "He comes here for cocaine, but he is of good English stock, and there are moments when he tries to shake himself free of me. For the last 3 weeks, as a matter of fact, he has disappeared entirely. I had great difficulty, Herr Baron, rediscovering his hiding place."
"I don't like that," returned the Baron. "How do you know what he has been up to in the meantime?"
He was silent for a minute. Then he looked with his cold, pale eyes into his elder's face.
"Manwitz," he exclaimed suddenly, "this may be the man for our business." For the first time a flicker of triumph lit in Manners' eyes. He went to his desk, unlocked a drawer, and produced a single sheet of notepaper. "This is a letter in his own writing, Herr Baron, signed by himself. I think it is satisfactory, eh?" The younger man took the sheet and fixed his keen eyes upon it. "My dear friend," ran the note, "the SS Polidor is due to leave H at 4 o'clock tomorrow, Tuesday afternoon. I have this on absolute authority. You can rely on it." The tall, fair-haired man came to the end of the brief note, and his hard mouth tightened. Then he read the postscript, "Don't forget the tabloids." He looked up slowly and fixed his keen eyes upon Manwitz's apoplectic countenance. Baron Rathenau, who had taken his degree at Oxford, who spoke English like an English gentleman, and possessed, on the surface, the manners of an English gentleman, was quite 5 years older than he looked. His brain was subtle and keen, and in the service of the fatherland he was hard and ruthless as steel. "You have done not so badly here, Manwitz," conceded the Baron. "This letter alone," he folded Treves's note carefully, "this letter alone would bring our young friend, Lieutenant Treves, into the presence of a firing squad within 48 hours. He paused a moment. "Our English enemies," he went on, "are unpleasantly hasty in regard to spies, but when it comes to traitors, the celerity with which they put a man's face to the wall in their Tower of London, it is marvelous." He had folded the note carefully, and, lifting his light fawn coat, he slipped Treves' note into the inner pocket. Then he flung the coat back again on the chair. "I'll see our young neurasthenic friend at once," he said. "You will leave him to me, Manwitz." He turned and pressed the bell twice. When the footman presently appeared at the door, Baron Rathenau was standing with his back to the mantelshelf, toying with a cigarette. "Bring up Mr. Treves, Conrad," he said briefly.
Well, folks, this brings us to the conclusion of another podcast. While you're here visiting the Windy Valley Digest, take a look around. We have folk tales, short stories, fables, and much more available to read, combined with some wonderful classic illustrations. If you have a comment or suggestion about the podcast, or anything on the website, drop us a line in the comment section below the show notes. Also, don't forget to visit and follow our Facebook page, and subscribe to our YouTube channel. Our final thought for today comes from one of America's greatest comedians, Groucho Marx. "Outside of a dog, a book is a man's best friend. Inside of a dog, it's too dark to read." Until next time, this is Vince Cowley for the Windy Valley Digest.